So from Nairobi to somewhere in another dimension. That sounds pretty 60s and 70s, doesn't it? And if the folklore's true, the more liberal among you probably did enjoy the occasional, actually probably the frequent joint. And if you think you were doing no harm, losing yourself in a haze of cannabis for a while, our next guest has news for you. The British writer and contrarian Peter Hitchens reckons cannabis is more than a drug. It's a political cause, even a religion. His latest book is called The War We Never Fought, The British Establishment's Surrender to Drugs. In it, Hitchens argues the adverse effects of cannabis go way beyond the user. Society at large is collectively stupefied by the drug culture. These days, even questioning so-called soft drug use can be radical. So radical that Peter Hitchens is coming here for next month's Festival of Dangerous Ideas at the Sydney Opera House. But we have got to him first. Peter Hitchens, welcome back to the Religion and Ethics Report.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Peter, you're coming to Australia for the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. Now, what does it suggest to you about contemporary Australia and obviously contemporary Britain that the notion of enforcing the laws that already exist against drug use now qualifies as a dangerous idea?
Well, it suggests to me that I'm right in what I say, which is that the major countries of the West have for many, many years been engaging in a covert, unstated decriminalisation of drugs which are formally illegal, and that this has now reached the point where nobody really takes it seriously in practice that these drugs are against the law, but there's an awful lot of political grandstanding and posturing, both by politicians who like to pretend that they're doing something, and by those who want a final legalisation of drugs, presumably so they can take commercial advantage of it, who rail against the alleged draconian prohibition so that the remaining laws can be demolished. But it is extremely risky to come out and say what I say, and it's generally excluded from public debate here. The idea that what has happened is one which can't really be readily stated. When I published my recent book on the subject, it was greeted either with total silence or with howls of execration in Britain.
Why, Peter, is the main focus of your book cannabis?
Because it seems to me to be the most common of the illegal drugs, the one which most of the current elite people now in their 50s, 60s, even 70s probably took when they were young and have a belief in as a harmless, almost sociable act of communion. In the new liberal revolution, I think when people were originally taking it back in the 60s and 70s, the passing round of the joint was in some way to them an equivalent of the passing of the communion cup. I don't mean to be sacrilegious here. I'm just saying that there is something about the ceremony of it and the induction which it provided to the new user to the world of hedonism, which has been very important ever since.
Well, you're not.
And the other thing about it which is very important is that it's been extraordinarily brilliantly publicized by people who really ought to be hired as public relations men by everybody who wants to make a bad thing look good. It is universally believed to be a so-called soft drug. In fact, it is one of the most dangerous of all the drugs because of the danger from it of irreversible mental illness.
Well, I hadn't thought of it in the way that you would put it, though, in a sacramental form. I mean, that is a very original way, but it does feed this idea that you suggest that cannabis is a cause.
Oh, it's very much a cause, and it stands for many other things apart from itself. It is the symbol, the cannabis leaf symbol, is the symbol of modern hedonism, of supposed sovereignty over the self, which is what people these days believe to be their absolute right, something they've got out of a misunderstood reading of John Stuart Mill, that everybody is an island unto himself and nobody has any business to interfere what I do with my body, which is invariably the response of the drug taker and indeed the sexual libertine, as I would call them, to any suggestion that the things they do might have any consequences beyond their own individual limbs.
I know that you're a good Anglican, so you partake in the sacrament of communion.
Right,
I am
good.
I am compelled to ask, in your Trotskyist days, did you participate in the sacrament of cannabis?
A couple of times I attempted to smoke it when I was at school. And as a non-smoker, I got no real effect from it. I have to say this because I've committed myself to being absolutely truthful about my past when asked. It was the most amazingly stupid thing to do, and I got off very lightly, but that's as far as it went. By the time I got to university, I was a Bolshevik Puritan, and I believed that drug-taking, drunkenness, and all these things were things which a revolutionary shouldn't do. So I was spared all that at university, where most of my coevals were smoking away like billy-ho.
You pointed there earlier, Peter, to the link between cannabis and mental illness. The other thing that really enrages you is the hypocrisy, or the apparent hypocrisy, about the way that the drug laws are structured, in the sense that it's very evil, as it were, to manufacture, to package, to transport, to market a drug. And yet, post-1971, it isn't quite so evil to use the drug.
Well, it's very odd, isn't it? It's a mystery far harder to penetrate than transubstantiation, it seems to me. You have this attitude where the law says that dealers and traffickers in drugs are immensely evil people who should be hunted down, warships churn the seas, special forces plunge through the jungles looking for them, great fuss is made when they're arrested. And yet the people who actually consume the drug itself are treated as if they're victims. Now, if the drug is evil, what is it that makes it evil? When it's inert, it has no more significance than soap. But it's only when it's used that the evil of it is apparent. And therefore, surely those who possess it and use it are as evil as those who supply it. And I absolutely don't see why this distinction is made. It makes no logical or moral sense at all. And this is also my answer to those people who say, well, what about the terrible things which the drug wars have done to, particularly to some countries in Latin America and Asia, where drug gangs and narco politics have ravaged whole countries with violence and corruption. And I say, well, the Mr. Big in this problem, the Mr. Big in this problem is you. It's Western, pseudo-intellectual, affluent youth who take these drugs and spend their dollars and pounds and euros on them, and therefore feed the whole narco industry in Latin America and Asia with vast quantities of money, which makes it worthwhile for people to take to violence and to arm themselves and to take over governments in pursuit of this trade, because it is so fantastically lucrative. The basis of it is the willingness of people to take these things, not the wickedness of the dealers, who are merely supplying a need. I'm not saying that the dealers and traffickers should be let off, but I really don't see why there should be a distinction in law between dealing and taking.
Just anticipating, though, the critique of that position, Peter, and this was raised in an interview that you did with Decca Aikenhead in The Guardian. She says, well, what about the users as victims? I mean, if you look not so much at cannabis, but heroin, where often the victims have had terrible lives.
Well, people have terrible lives, but that doesn't excuse them doing terrible things. And I don't think that we should be in the business of making excuses for people to do stupid things. If you've had a terrible life, one way to absolutely guarantee it will get more terrible is to start taking drugs.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report, you're with me, Andrew West, and we're speaking with Peter Hitchens. He's back this year to talk about his new book, The War We Never Fought, The British Establishment Surrender to Drugs. Peter, let's talk about the meta-narrative behind this book. The debate about cannabis is a metaphor, I think, for something much bigger in your book. And what is that?
It is fundamentally about hedonism. It's about people being permitted to pursue their own pleasures at the expense of others. And it's about the current belief that the supreme law of life is personal autonomy. And that really is, more than anything else, what this debate is about. It's a moral debate. It's not a particularly political debate or a health debate. It's a debate about what kind of society we have. And the reason why it's particularly important is because the societies which have now adopted semi-legal or covertly legal drugs are societies which were previously Christian societies, often Protestant Christian societies, self-disciplined, and very far from this hedonist position. And people seem to imagine that you can drop the moral positions, the self-restraint, the self-discipline of the Protestant society, and enter an era of hedonism and not expect to pay a price for it. Once you've abandoned these ideas of self-control and self-discipline, apart from anything else, the basic Edmund Burke formula comes in. The less people are prepared to place restraints upon their own behavior, the more outward chains and restrictions will have to be placed on them by government and the law.
Let me quote to you what I think is a key line here. You say drug decriminalisation, by its very nature, will make it harder to sustain a competent, thoughtful, self-disciplined, hard-working and efficient society.
Well, I think that's self-evident, isn't it? I mean, once you have said that people are allowed, without disapproval or legal sanction, to stupefy themselves for large parts of their day, particularly using drugs whose effects are long-term and unpredictable, then we are going to have to get used to the fact that either we're all going to be subject all the time to urine and blood tests for the presence of drugs in our bodies, or you're going to be worried about your school bus driver and your airline pilot and your surgeon and all the other people whose skills and precision and self-discipline you depend on for a civilized society.
The second part of that paragraph in which you say it will also create, this is drug dependency, it will also create contentment and apathy where discontent and a passion for reform should be. And that leads to the other key philosophical point that you're raising, which is, at least to me, you seem to be saying that drug use doesn't just drag down the user, but it allows other social forces to get away with mischief, if not even villainy.
Well, if I were, as I'm always accused of being, a conspiracy theorist, whatever exactly that is, I would be tempted to conclude that there were some people in our power elite who saw the idea of a stupefied population as really rather attractive. A stupefied population won't vote against them. A stupefied population won't be discontented at their incompetence and their failures. A stupefied population will just lie about giggling while they get on with messing up the country. And you can see why that might be appealing to quite a lot of politicians. Whether they've got enough sense to actually put two and two together and actively promote this, I rather doubt, but it does seem to have happened at the same time as we've acquired in most of the Western countries some of the most incompetent political classes and indeed administrative classes of modern history.
Well, this is the Aldous Huxley Brave New World scenario of Soma. Now, remind us about that book and why you consider it a far more prophetic book than even George Orwell's 1984.
Well, much more prophetic, because what George Orwell prophesied was actually something which came and to a great extent went in terms of totalitarian surveillance. We do have, I have to say, a lot of the surveillance which he foresaw in 1984, but it's not totalitarian. It's largely accepted. In Huxley's case, what he predicted was a society in which people came to love their own serfdom. And one of the ways they came to love their own serfdom was through this drug Soma, which in the opening pages of the book is described as having been created by hundreds of biochemists over a period of years with the deliberate intent of providing an escape, a hangover-free escape without none of the disadvantages of alcohol or Christianity, as it's described, which you could take various quantities of either to overcome the general discontents of daily life or to have a complete holiday from daily life, a Soma holiday where you've just disappeared in a sweet stupor. Mm-hmm. It's also used significantly in one moment in the book as a riot control device.
I remember that from my high school reading of it, sprayed liberally into the air.
Sprayed, and in the end all the rioters end up weeping and hugging each other. Huxley did later write about this in an essay some years after the book had been published, saying this had been the thing which had worried him most and increasingly worried him that we would come to love our own servitude. And it's not just illegal drugs that are involved in this. The huge, wide-scale prescription these days of so-called antidepressants is another feature of this, of society turning away from actual active discontent and into passive self-stupefaction as an alternative to worrying about things which people, by and large, feel it's too much trouble to change. Mm.
Give us a contemporary example, though, of what Huxley was talking about being in practice.
I just did. I think if you look, I don't know what the figures are in Australia. I don't have them to hand in our own country. But the prescription of these drugs called antidepressants is particularly common in Britain, I have to say, in areas of high unemployment.
Just as we wind up, Peter, the key moral lesson, I think, that comes out of your book, and you say it quite explicitly, you say the sort of self-stupefaction that results from drug use, it is morally wrong. Now, why is self-stupefaction morally wrong as opposed to practically wrong for some of the reasons that you've outlined?
Well, all religion is morally based, and for me it's quite simple. We were given by God our faculties, so that we could observe what was around us and respond to it in a moral fashion. If instead of using those faculties, we deliberately dull them so that we do not see or hear or feel or even smell the wickedness which is going on around us, and turn ourselves into passive, giggling beings, self-satisfied and set apart from the world around us rather than actively engaged in it. We are shirking our responsibilities as human beings.
There's also a sense that I detected in which many people who might quite easily be able to handle drug use, and you like to quote that person who boasted of smoking his or her way through Oxford and still getting a first, in demanding lax laws or no laws for themselves, they're kind of making those who are of weaker character perhaps a little more vulnerable. Well, I can handle it, but they're sort of making the weak pay.
There is certainly an immensely selfish, straightforward Kantian point about this. If you license this for yourself, you license it for everybody. If you license it for the rich, well-off, middle-class person who can get through life even slightly damaged because the family will rally and there will be lots of cushions and safety nets, you're licensing it for the poor person in the grotty, dirty, crime-ridden part of town as well. And you cannot have one law for the nice, educated, middle-class person and another law for the others. If you say this is legal, it's legal for everybody.
Now, finally, your book is subtitled The British Establishment's Surrender to Drugs. So why is this movement to liberalise drug laws peppered with people who have titles like Sir and Dame and Lord and Baroness?
Because these people have now become the establishment, because people like me, who grew up in the 1950s and went through university education in the 1960s and early 1970s, are now in charge, and they now have these titles, and they appear to be part of a staid and stolid establishment. They're not at all. They remain, undoubtedly, they remain extremely radical. They wear the suits and the ties and the smart clothes, and they speak in educated accents, but they are revolutionaries. And Kierkegaard said that the most successful revolutions are those in which all the buildings are left standing, everything appears to be the same, but in fact, life has been utterly changed.
Now, I do have one point on which I want to remonstrate with you. What is your problem, Peter, with continental cafes? Because that was one of the things that Richard Crossman wanted for Britain. I've got to say, I tore through your book in about 3 or 4 hours while sitting in one of these cafes.
Oh, I've nothing against continental cafes at all.
Rather derisively of them in the book.
No, I don't.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between...
No, you misread it if you think that. What I speak derisively of is the belief of Anthony Crossland and the belief of two British governments which have proceeded on this basis, that you can introduce continental Southern European styles of drinking and indeed drinking licensing laws to Britain. It doesn't work in northern beer-drinking wet countries with misty skies and cold winters for many, many reasons. And we have in this country acquired almost unlimited drinking now, whereas for most of my life it was very heavily restricted. And the result is horrible Hogarthian mass drunkenness. The city centres of Britain now on Friday and Saturday nights are lakes of vomit and screaming and, semi-conscious girls with their skirts hoiked up around their pockets. No, I'm not joking. This is what you
I
see.
Know you're not.
We have not taken well to it. And this was the mistake that people like Crossman and Crossland made, that you could somehow apply the rules of Southern European countries to Northern Europe. It's a separate question to some extent, but only to some extent. The problem of alcohol is an enormous one, and which, alas, cannot be addressed as, say, cannabis can be, because it's been so long in our culture and been legal so long, it would be almost impossible to ban it now. But it's undoubtedly a major problem. And the idea that you can, that it would do any good to add another legal poison to our society seems to me to be extraordinary.
Let me, in closing, just draw the distinction, Peter, between, you know, the cheap off-license and the Viennese or the Hungarian continental cafe. And when you come to Sydney, I hope you'll let me take you to one of those louche continental cafes.
I shall look forward to it.
Peter Hitchens is a columnist with The Mail on Sunday. His latest book is called The War We Never Fought, The British Establishment Surrender to Drugs. Peter will be in Australia in a few days to speak at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. Peter, thanks so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that is where we leave today's edition of the show. Our stories are at our homepage on the RN website. You can download or stream them. You can leave a comment. And we're on Twitter at ABC Religion. And thanks this week to producer Jess Hill and to our technical producer, Paul Goff. Next week, the Religion and Ethics Report comes live from Brisbane. And I'm there with some of the world's top religion journalists and we'll be debating the role of religion in understanding world affairs. But next, it's Drive with Waleed Ali. Waddo Waleed.
Hey, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm well. Now, last week, you threw out a challenge about the correlation between eating pork and the lower sperm count.
Yeah, and I noted in your voice that you sound a little emasculated. Well, what did I say?
Well, you wanted me to look at the religious aspect, the prohibition on eating pork. Now, I heard your guest, Rod Lambert, from the ANU, say that he thought the science was a bit wobbly. Those were his words.
I wasn't impressed.
Yes, well, we put it through the faith filter. It's at least half bollocks. Because, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, where pork isn't exactly on the menu due to religious prohibitions, the birth rate has plummeted 75% in the 30 years since the revolution. But if you go to the West Bank, the Palestinian West Bank, among the Orthodox Jewish settlers, who I also doubt eat pork, the average birth rate is 6 children per woman. But in France, the longer immigrant women of any faith are there, the smaller their families become, which I think suggests that too much jambon fromage, the classic ham and cheese sandwich, isn't good for anyone. So any more requests?
Well, I like that you've done your homework.
We always do, my friend.
You're probably on a distinction there. Not quite a high distinction, because I'd need to see you control for political and economic circumstances. So that's your next project.
You were an academic, yes.
I came from a classroom today, Andrew, and we didn't talk about bacon and sperm count. But anyway, on the show today, it's Bird Week. I don't know if you knew that. We're looking for Australia's favourite bird. If anyone's got any suggestions, perhaps they can let us know. It's one of the activities of Bird Week. Lots of news to get through as well. It'll all happen after the news. See you in 10.